And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning, Mark Beckner, is the author of The Coder's Path to Wealth and Independence. Beckner's written a book for the writers of software, a book that details how they can break away from working for someone else to build their own solo practice and hopefully generate some money and some independence.
That's right. Good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Our second guest this morning is Robert Celaya. He's the founder of American MedChem. Now, there are over 6,000 rare diseases that are known today. These collectively present a significant public health burden, since 25 to 30 million patients are afflicted by these diseases in North America alone. Many of these are serious genetic diseases that strike young children. MedChem is a nonprofit that's committed to discovering and developing small molecule-based medicines to treat children who suffer from rare or neglected diseases.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning is Mark Beckner, author of The Coder's Path to Wealth and Independence. Beckner shows software coders, people that write software, how to transform themselves from a skilled programmer into a highly creative and effective business person leveraging the skills that they already have. The book tells them how they can create opportunities where none have existed, create value for themselves and those that they work with, substantially increase their income, define their ideals, and realize their dreams. Mark Beckner, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Yeah. So some pretty big claims in the book, create opportunities, create value, substantially increase their income. Is this something that you wanted to do as a software developer working for somebody else?
Well, this is, you know, this comes from kind of stepping away from working for somebody else, right? It's like there's the whole technology field, there's millions of us out there, right? And there's sort of a trend for people to step away from an employer and go into, you know, independent practice. They could just go out and find a project here, find a project there. And what I wanted to do was say for people who are stepping out and doing their own thing, you can do what other folks are doing and make a nice income, because in technology and in computer programming, there's, you know, certainly a you can have a nice, decent income and a quality of life that that you can't complain about. But if you're going to be doing that, you can really take it to a very different level and do more with your time, do more with your resources, both professionally and in the world.
Okay, so these folks would be, let's say, working for a corporation doing software coding, and they're project-focused. Now you're talking about them going out and being an independent consultant to outsource their software coding, to break away and start a development organization, all the possibilities there, or is it aimed towards a specific vocation?
Right. I mean, as soon as so this is aimed for developers and consultants and technology, but there's a lot of it that applies to virtually anybody. But the programmer who's sitting there working for someone, in the early years, you're building up your skills and you're really learning how you know, business functions and how you function, and really becoming you know, a quality resource, right? There's some years of development, but at a certain point, you no longer need to grow under the umbrella of an employer, right? You have the expertise to go out if you want to and do something that's really your own, that's creative, that allows allows you to go in a direction that you would never be able to when you're employed.
Mark, let's do a little stereotyping here if we can. You know, we push so many kids now into the STEM, the area of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We're really saying there's so many jobs in technology. You know, think about that while you're in high school. Go into that when you're in college. But, you know, it takes a certain personality to become a programmer. Right? I mean, we think of like engineers, you know, they might be very concentrated in math, but may not have the most, have the big personalities that we think of someone that would be an entrepreneur. Is it that same sort of thing with those in the software development and, you know, coders in general?
There's so much opportunity within technology. I mean, coders is you think of the guy sitting down in his basement who hasn't bathed in a couple of weeks, right? But there's those stereotypes, but the reality is that the opportunities are so immense that it's not about personality or, you know, whether you're introvert or extrovert or, you know, you like to talk or you don't like people. It doesn't really have to do with that. It has to do with, is there a job? Is there work, right? I mean, think about throughout history. I mean, it's like, you know, during the Great Depression, everybody went out and picked peaches. You know, was their personality type defining what they did? No, it was circumstance. It was, you know, what was available to do. Now we have all sorts of options, but in technology, there's just virtually endless work. I mean, there's so much demand for resources that your personality is not going to define whether you can do it or not, because there's different things you can do. You can program in a cube. You can program in Teams. You can, you know, do quality assurance, which is really more focused on the people aspect of it, working with people. You know, there's all sorts of aspects to sort of that generic term of technologist or.
But there must be something lacking or some sort of myopic view of the world of technology, or you wouldn't have written this book, really reminding people that they can be creative and imaginative and break out of working for someone else.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it and I say, okay, so here are people who are good at what they do, and they can do better, right? I mean, the book is really about what are pragmatic steps to be successful when you want to be independent, right? How can you make a business out of it? But then there's also ideas in there about how to, once you're doing this, how to really break out of the mold and go to a level that allows you to become who you really need to be professionally and privately, right? If you're, all of us have idealistic goals and dreams, right? I mean, there's things we want to do in the world. There's visions that we want to put out there, and oftentimes we, for whatever reason, don't have the opportunity to do that. No longer as a developer do you have the opportunity to say, well, you know, if I only had enough money, or if I only had enough time, or if only I didn't work for this company, I could go do it. You have the opportunity professionally to do really great things that will allow you to do really great things in your life. I mean, it's kind of a choice, right? You can go along marginally and work for somebody and make $90,000 a year and, you know, be fine with that, right? Or you can push yourself a little bit, make five times as much, have five times as much free time to go do what you want to do and really try to make an impact on the world rather than just sort of taking the back seat and letting things drive for you.
The folks that I know that are in software development that are working for companies that are really thriving, they're very busy. They're putting 60 hours at least a week in, and it's a good job, but it's a tough job. Now they want to break away. What is the first step? I'm curious, and how does someone that only has known coding, maybe they started when they were 12 or 13, and they've been doing this, and they got out of school, and they sort of took this natural path. How do they understand markets? How do they understand cursory techniques in sales to be able to present themselves, to present their product, to be able to go out and get business? How do they do that?
Well, I think it's really more of an organic approach to it, where you you don't really need to know a whole lot other than your craft to go find work. So in the situation where you are employed by an employer and you're working 60-hour weeks, I mean, that happens to everybody. Why do you want to do that? 60, 80 hours a week every week, you don't get to do anything else with your life. So the first step is to say to your employer, I mean, that's your most likely source of income, to say, listen, I need to make a change. I have to go out on my own. I have to move somewhere else, whatever it is. Do you see value in continuing to work with me, right? It's a conversation. It's an open discussion. You have to be very ready to go out and end your employment. And so if you're going to end it, you might as well talk to them about potentially continue on as a contractor, right? Maybe that is something you do for a year or two as you start to build relationships with other clients that are out there. But your current employer is a very likely source of work, right? That allows you to sort of step out and with a very nice cushion with immediate work and start to learn how to be independent. Now, that's not an option for everybody. A lot of employers say, well, you need to be here on site. That's the job. And so you have to be convinced in your mind of the value of starting to do your own thing. There is work out there. You can go get a job as a contractor, as a subcontractor, very, very quickly. There's all sorts of placement firms. There's, all sorts of ways to find work. Unfortunately, most of those mean that you have to go travel. Every single week you have to go sit in some other city and do work, but you have to allow yourself to get into that pattern and then start to develop the sense of talking with people, letting them know you're available, and grow organically to really become independent and then move into understanding business, understanding how do I find projects more in line with the market that I want to be in, right?
A lot of companies already have experience with outsourcing and working with outside contractors, and they don't want to have an employee necessarily where they have to pay all of the benefits, so it's actually easier sometimes for them to do that. And my son, for an example, who works for Cognizant, which is it's a Fortune 500 consulting firm, he does software development for them during the day in North Carolina. And they have a meeting every morning, first thing in the morning, with these folks from India that were coding all through the night while they were sleeping, and they're working on these projects together. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of ways to share and break these projects up and to make contacts in the contract world and in the under the corporate umbrella world.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's the reason that outsourcing is now almost in every single company is because there's just not enough. Well, one of the reasons is there's not enough resources here, and number two, the price, right? But the price point is such that resources in India cost $40-$45 an hour, right? They're not earning that, but the companies that you're outsourcing with will charge that. For you as an independent person to work at a fee that's sort of in line with that, I don't really like the hourly model, so it's not that. There's all sorts of concepts in the book about alternative ways to work with people, but you can come up with an effective rate that really puts you in line with what folks in the third world are charging, right? So there's ways to be creative about how you engage. There's ways to be creative about how you charge on projects that really makes it a non-issue as far as you versus outsourced resource, right?
That's interesting. What would you say, Mark, to the college student, for example, who's learning how to write code and gets to the point, maybe midway through college where they go, there are those from India and China who are much better programmers, much better at writing code, charging less. So, gosh, where do I go now? I mean, what would you say to that college student?
Well, you have to get experience. Like, you have to go get work before you're going to be any good at it. Like, people who are working, who've been working professionally for 5 or 10 years, of course they're going to be better coders than somebody who's in college, right? And maybe the college student knows more, can program an operating system, but the value of that in the real world is minimal, right? There's, can you develop business software and things like that? The ability to code, like, you don't have to be an incredible coder to be really good business coder, right? Because it's a different type of programming. The college kids will go in and do very, you know, detailed deep dives, really learn a language, and then you come to find out in the world 90% of the jobs are not that in depth. It's just like, can you come in and modify software? Can you come in and add, you know, the ability to integrate data between systems, right? So it's not like you have to compare yourself on a, hey, they're a better coder, but you have to have experience. You have to have some understanding of how things are done and something to go on before you go and say, hey, I'm out here and working for myself. Like, I wouldn't say, hey, college person, go, you know, never be employed, never go learn your craft before you try to go independent.
I have some thoughts on that. I think that there's a percentage of coders that are in sort of a sweatshop where they don't have a lot of contact with people, and they're just there just knocking this code out. But then there's a pretty healthy percentage of those that are interfacing with other people and have to be able to present well and those sorts of things. So my advice to the college student is, to the extent that they can, learn as much as you can about communicating one-to-one, one-to-few, one-to-many, being able to do that electronically, verbally, in a PowerPoint-type environment, and learn to communicate ideas and take as many sales and marketing classes so that you can really be ready for anything that could happen out there once you get out there. You may desire to be in software development in that area of technology, but if you really have good communication skills, they're going to serve you well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, if you're in college and you want to go be a computer programmer deep dive, then you get your degree in computer programming. But if you want to take your computer skills, like you're already a good coder and you want to be successful in business, then don't necessarily get your degree in computer science. Go get it in English or history or business or something like that to give you a more well-rounded idea of the world, because you've already got the computer science skills and you can go get a job in the business world with any degree, right? Saying, hey, right, I know how to program. Yeah. That's all you need.
So, Mark, somebody's out there, they're working for somebody else. They have established some good experience. They've got some good reviews. They've learned their craft. Now they want to get out on their own. What are give me a couple of the top obstacles that they bump into when they're doing that?
Well, I'd say the number one thing you need to do before you do that is identify why, right? You must have goals beyond just saying, hey, I'm tired of working for somebody, or I want to make more money. Like, you need a real tangible, you know, set of goals to go after. Like, what is it that you're trying to do? Do you want to live somewhere else? Do you want to, you know, spend more time with your kids? Do you want to, whatever it is that ultimately is driving you to make this change has to be identified, right? You have to be able to write it down and say, this is what I want. And then when you have those things clearly in mind, your ability to make steps towards getting there becomes much clearer, right? So the primary obstacle, I think, in going independent is identifying why do you want to do that, right? And if you don't have that goal there and you walk out the door, especially if you walk out the door of a good paying job, it's like, well, why am I doing this? This is a lot of work, you know, because it is a lot of work to get ramped up and, you know, really get your business going. It will take a while. It'll take, you know, year, 2 years before you're really, you know, at a place right where you have a baseline. And if you're walking away from a $100,000 job, it's like, well, I should just go back and work for them again. So you have to have those goals in mind. That's your primary, you know, deterrent. If you don't have those, then where are you headed?
Right. Okay. The book is The Coder's Path to Wealth and Independence. Mark Beckner, thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much.
Okay. When we return, we will have a conversation with Robert Celia. He's the founder of American MedCam that will be developing medicines for children with rare diseases. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Why is underwriting on KPCW the best way to promote your business? Because KPCW is everybody's first choice for news, weather, and traffic. Because KPCW brings our community together. So let KPCW bring the community to your business in Summit and Wasatch Counties. Great opportunity at a great value. For underwriting, contact me, Emily, at 435-901-8805 or Emily at kpcw.org.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake. Info at hideoutcanyon.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law. LRW-law.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Wasatch & Wool Yarns is the newest sponsor of KPCW's Classified Show. We offer yarns from Noro, Blue Sky Alpaca, Jade Sapphire, Classic Elite, and more, along with knitting classes for all abilities, knitting accessories, and weekly knit nights. Located at the Redstone Shopping Center, wasatchandwool.com.
Hola, soy Jorge, uno de los anfitriones de Cada Domingo. Escuche Cada Domingo en KPCW 91.9 FM. Todos los domingos en las tardes de las 7 a las 10 p.m. Tenemos música, información de la comunidad y perdidos y encontrados. Por favor, denle like o me gusta a la página Facebook de Cada Domingo. Cada domingo, solo en Park City, solo KPCW. Hi, I'm Jorge, one of the hosts for KPCW's Cada Domingo. You can hear Cada Domingo every Sunday evening on KPCW 91.9 FM from 7 to 10 p.m., where you can hear music, community information, and lost and founds. Please like the KPCW Cada Domingo Facebook page. Cada Domingo, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host John Wells. We were just speaking with Mark Beckner, author of The Coder's Path to Wealth and Independence. Our next guest is Robert Celaya. He's the founder of American MedChem. Dr. Celaya has more than 18 years of experience in technology, leadership, and management in drug discovery, medicinal chemistry, and preclinical development in the U.S. and the global pharmaceutical and biotech sector. He was most recently president of medicinal chemistry at SAI Advantium in Pharma in India, where he led over a group of 200 scientists. Now his new company, MedChem, will discover and develop small molecule-based medicines to treat children who suffer from rare or neglected diseases. And there are more of them than you'd think. MedChem scientists believe they can expedite the path to these breakthrough medicines. Robert Celaya, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you. Now, you must remember along the way here that this is a lay talk show. In other words, we like to make science kind of break it down into things that are, you know, bits that are understandable and accessible to the average folk. So let's go back to, we have this thing called the human genome.
Right.
And we have genes.
Right.
Explain, if you would, and I've heard some interesting explanations to explain the human genome, but I bet you can do it for us.
Right. Let me back up a little bit. I mean, I love the fact that you mentioned community. And in a way, we as a nonprofit, we want to bring this science to the community. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the thinking about pharmaceutical research is, you know, bright scientists behind glass doors wearing white lab coats and goggles, you know, doing their thing. But every pill that we take has come through the hands of someone like myself, because there's an active ingredient which we, drug designers, medicinal chemists, create. So with AMC, I really want to bring this to the community, invite undergraduates, even high school kids to come and participate in a small internship or something like that. So get the word out that this is very accessible stuff.
Well, that's a really great point. And, yes, you know, as you know, in our schools, in our high schools and colleges, even beginning now in the elementary schools, they are trying to create science-based curriculum so that it is more accessible and it's not something that we shy away from. So
yes.
So that's a great idea. Yes. We'll make sure that we mention that.
It's esoteric for those who want to think about it that way. But I think it is, it's humanity that's doing this. I mean, ancient people have been collecting, gathering plants and samples as medicines, and now we do it differently. So now to get to the genome part, what's happening is recently President Obama articulated precision medicine. That is entirely anchored on this human genome project, which is revealing itself slowly to us about the secrets of diseases, right? And secrets of metabolism, you know, secrets of how our bodies process medicine, right? So what's going to happen now is we would be able to diagnose diseases based on genetics, right? So there's going to be exact diagnosis for diseases. We're already doing this for adults, right? There are several drugs out there, beautiful drugs. If people call it a silver bullet, yes, they are, because they are clean, they have minimal side effects, and therapeutic value is huge, right? So so we are arriving at that very slowly because it was a big bit of data information that scientists had to process. So now we are at the vanguard, I would say, of doing this. AMC wants to do this for children also, right?
And historically, we've had broad-based medicine. We're going to go after cancer. We're going to go after tuberculosis, or you know, and this is for the masses. And now this is a really individualized, personalized, as we have these targeted treatments because of the genome and other diagnostic tools that are you know, presenting themselves.
Right.
So this is the way of the future.
This is the way of the future, and. Personalized medicine is a great term. That's the term that has been used for a long time. But I'm beginning to admire the word precision medicine that President Obama in his State of the Union addressed, because I think it is gathering a lot of brains behind this idea of precision medicine. I think we should talk about it in those terms. Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, I know you're going to be focusing on children, but there's a difference between children and adults. Children are not small adults.
Yes,
they're completely different in the way you approach the genetic sequencing and the treatment.
Yes,
the targeted treatments. Yes. What is that difference?
The difference is this: children's bodies is a great point. Actually, children's bodies are still developing. Right, adult bodies have developed. So if you think of the various organs, the brain, the endocrinal system, and various things like that are still in the process of developing in children, right? So when you treat them, for example, in pediatric cancer, which falls right into a rare disease category, when you treat children with chemotherapeutic agents, which are really toxic agents, in adults, these drugs will select fast-growing cancer cells and kill them, and there is hair loss and maybe appetite loss, maybe the gut lining gets hammered, right? Now, you take that same drug and give it to children, this is what we are doing now, the brain development is hammered because all the organ, endocrine system of the child is getting hammered. After treatment, not only are they losing hair, there's stunted growth, fertility is gone, you know. So these damages are happening to children, right? So to me, it is not right that we take these chemotherapeutic drugs and give it to children. Honestly, if today a drug company took a chemotherapeutic agent to FDA and said, please approve this for children's use, FDA will walk them out the door because it's not acceptable, right? But because there is no medicine, we are using it as off-label in children. So these clinical oncologists are also struggling with this treatment modalities, right? So precision medicine is the way to go.
So interesting. So, as John called it, individualized medicine, you and President Obama are calling it precision medicine. I've also heard it called individualized medicine. To back up a bit, this has all been allowed by the mapping of the human genome, correct?
Yes, very
and
true.
That took from 1990 to 2002 or something to map the human genome full-time, 24/7, hundreds of scientists at the cost of like nearly $3 billion or something. Excuse me. And so talk a little bit about that mapping and how it allows precision medicine.
So that was sort of the key to the entry into medicine itself.
Like never really entered medicine until this point. Huh?
Yeah. So John brought up the point of how previously we would do placebo-controlled, large pivotal clinical studies with, you know, better than placebo as a measure of goodness of a drug. Right?
Let's treat the masses.
Yes, treat the masses. But what has genomics done, what has human genome mapping has done is it has kind of opened the door to, can we go exactly to the cause of a disease, the underlying root cause? And that is where we are going to be targeting treatment for adults and for children, right? So that's a huge door opener, if I want to simplify it. I'm not a geneticist, so I don't want to go into specifics of, you know, how that all happened. But that effort, I mean, the technology, the intellect, the money, was a huge door opener for pharmaceutical research. Yeah.
So is that then the difference between, we've had genetic testing around for a long time, but not genomic testing. And that's what we're doing to be able to really...
I think those terms are very similar. Genetic testing is what we call it now.
Mm-hmm.
A genome is a big word,
right?
All-encompassing word. But genetic testing is when you go after diagnostics. Now what they are promoting is organization like National Organization for Rare Disorders is for testing children early on for diseases,
you know,
like we do for, you know, Down syndrome and things like that. You know, can we test children who probably have some kind of a predisposition, a family history or something like that, to test them and treat them early? You know, another beautiful thing that, you know, we tend to forget, as you brought up, John, about children versus adults, children's bodies are very resilient, right? When you hammer them with a sledgehammer of a drug called chemotherapeutic, you don't even give them a chance to recover a full life. You know? Whereas if you go with precision medicine, and help them, sometimes the body may recover itself, right? So maybe for a 2-3 year period, we want to treat them with this precision medicine. And as their body is developing, it might take, we don't know that yet now, because we treat them with chemotherapeutic agents and radiation and bone marrow transplant and things like that.
There was a video that I looked at last night where there were three vignettes. There were three parents that had children that were talking about situations that, you know, how the kids were sick. And this one young man, when they did the genetic testing, and he was a baby at the time, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they found that there was his genetics were good, but there was one protein that was being overly produced, and it was being produced in the wrong way, and that was and they could target that. You could target that, and that could you know, specifically help him.
Yeah.
Can you correct me on that?
Yes.
I know I've got that one wrong.
So that's the technology. I mean, you described it in very, very simple terms, but if you dig a little bit deeper, that is the technology. What do any of the medicines in the pills that we take, what do? They disrupt a pathway which is corrective.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
If it is overproduction of a wrong protein, perhaps we can go shut that down.
Right.
Right. If there's an enzyme that is overly active and leading to, you know, disease process, we can go in and shut them down. So these are the mechanisms that we're talking about. I mean, in general terms, yes, there are methods to, you know, shut down proteins and bring about a cure. But specifically, that is what drug discovery and medicinal chemistry does day in and day out.
Right.
Finding these molecules to disrupt.
So the child is ill.
Yes.
There's 10 children. They all have the same symptoms.
Yes.
And then you go into the genetic testing, and you can find that one has a protein that they're overproducing and one has something else. So this is where the personalized, targeted, individualized medicine comes in,
in that
you're treating the specifics of that individual.
Yes, and there's a bit of breadth to that, meaning... if, for example, 20 children present with a particular genetic disease, and we target that particular pathway for these 20 children, that's also personalized medicine for these children, right? So
right.
It doesn't have to be, I mean, individualized can be taken to the extreme of one person per treatment, right? But individualized is also sort of a collective because genetically they present the same disease modality, so to speak, and then you treat those 20 children. Now, for example, in adults, breast cancer 20 years ago, 10 years ago, used to be considered one disease. Now it is at least four diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And we can genetically identify those four different groups and treat them with either, you know, steroid inhibitor drugs or certain mechanistic pathways, right? So we, in lung cancer, it has become the same thing, right? So we are not treating cancer as one disease, or lung cancer as one disease, or breast cancer as one disease, or even prostate cancer as one disease. They're going to break down into multiple diseases within breast cancer, within pancreatic cancer, within lung cancer. This is the beauty of this new technology of diagnostics.
So how much are we seeing now, currently, precision medicine being applied? I mean, say two parents take their child into the oncology department at Primary Children's Hospital, and they're told, well, we used to do it this way. There was this protocol for XYZ cancer that was the same for 20 years. It worked. It has a 98% success rate. But what we found is that we can target it a little better, and we're doing this different thing. I mean, is that happening yet, or is it coming, you know, in the next decade, two decades?
I would say it's coming because today the tools that, say, a pediatric oncologist has are protocols which are standardized by the FDA for treatment. And they are supposed to be the first-line treatment for children with cancer, which all include a selected chemotherapeutic agents. And mind you, chemotherapeutic agents are really selecting only for fast-growing cells. And cancer is defined as fast-growing. But in a children, fast-growing is almost every cell. Right, so that's where it breaks down. But when we, like American Medchem and also other pharmaceutical companies, put out drugs which are very specific for pathways, then the oncologists say, look, your child has this particular genetic pathway for this pediatric cancer. We have this new medicine for it. So those new medicines have to come into the hands of clinicians.
It sounds wonderful, but how many roadblocks are there from the FDA because of the very fact that it's precision and, you know, yes, an individual? There's not a protocol for a wide spectrum of people.
Yes. I mean, this is where, I mean, even the FDA is watching the technology.
Mm-hmm.
You see, FDA cannot be proactive in the sense that, you know, here is precision medicine, so we are going to do everything differently. FDA deals with when a drug sponsor brings a category of drug to them, they look at it and say, yes, this makes sense, and we are going to review it and approve it with your study results, right? So FDA is always, I look at FDA as a guard to make sure that patients get the right medicines. Not snake oil, right? That's exactly what the FDA's role is. So FDA doesn't drive the technology, but they embrace the technology. So I don't call the FDA a roadblock.
Okay.
Right? It is actually, they are there to facilitate us. And what's happening now is with this technology of precision medicine, and if you can have an exact diagnosis, so the diagnostic tool and the treatment tool, if they go to the FDA at the same time, our clinical studies are going to be exact. We are not going to be doing placebo-controlled 30,000 patient studies, which is the old way of doing business.
Mm-hmm.
Now we are going to say, here I can select these patients with this genetic testing tool, and here I have the treatment test compound, right? So,
if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Robert Celaya, who is the founder of American Medchem that will be developing medicines for children with rare diseases. Currently, the genetic testing has a really a wide range of pricing options from $100 to $2,000. Is that because of different complexities, or is that because of where you go to have the testing?
So the trend is downwards, right? I mean, if 5 years ago, genetic testing would have been $1 million cost.
Hmm.
That price point has come down to very accessible, maybe $1,000, you know, $300, whatever it is. I mean, there are companies that are driving this technology really to be fast, efficient, data-driven, so that it becomes accessible.
Okay.
Another leg in this whole study, whole technology, is physicians have to be trained to use genetic data.
Right.
Right. So that, if you talk about, I don't call it a roadblock, but that's an education. So I think these technology companies that are developing genetic tests are also responsible, I feel, to teach people how to use genetic data, right?
So a mom and dad have a child that is sick, and they can't seem to figure out why the child is sick. Do they need to change pediatricians to find someone that is certainly open to the genetic testing side of it? Or do they break away from that pediatrician and find you? Patients don't specifically come to you directly. You provide these services for these rare diseases and provide that to the general community. So they wouldn't seek you out. They need to find a pediatrician that is working with genetic testing. I'm not sure how all this
yes.
works.
So let me just alter that a little bit. American Medchem is not into genetic testing.
Okay.
Right? We are into creating drugs. Genetic testing is done by specialists who are geneticists. And most pediatricians today have access to genetic counselors. Like, so if you go to primary children's, there are several genetic counselors. So what's happening, the way it's going to work is if a pediatrician is presented with a difficult diagnosis, I think they'll bring a genetic counselor into that team of, treatment team. And perhaps they will initiate a gene test, a genetic test, and the genetic counselor will be able to work with the parent and the pediatrician and say, this is what we think is going on, and here's the evidence for it. And if at that time AMC has provided a drug for that, they will say, here it is. Right? But otherwise, it'll stop with the diagnosis. Maybe they'll keep the child comfortable and things like that. So it is not a matter of switching from one to the other, but rather, engaging the genetic counselors early on in mm-hmm. the treatment process, I should say. Yeah.
American Medchem, that you founded and you're the CEO of, is a nonprofit. Why nonprofit?
Yes, that's a very good question. Let me put a general spin on it. When we bring forth children into this world, we never think of them as profit loss.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So that's something that drives me. But why is it when it comes to medicines, we look at children and say they are not a profitable sector because few patients get it. The same level of technology, depth, and breadth has to be applied for 500 children's disease. And it's not profitable, so we don't want to do it. I mean, it is not to blame the industry, but the industry model of, being driven by profits doesn't engage these projects, right? So mm-hmm. it's just the model doesn't work. So if you step outside the box in a classic business talk, if you step outside the box and say, how do we help these children? Because the need is there, the technology is there, the talent is there, the profit is not there. Do we still walk away or do we say, forget the profits, let's create the drugs for children, right? So I go with that. Let's create the drugs for children, let the children be well, and we'll have a good night's sleep.
Very nice. So talk a little bit about the difference. You come from India. You worked.
I'm from Sri Lanka.
Okay, Sri yes. Lanka. All right. But you had worked in India
yes.
and led this group of scientists.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. that was until what year?
2010. Yeah.
2010. Yeah. So you've spent most of your professional life in India and or Sri Lanka working and you look like you're about to answer that question.
Okay, let me answer that. I'm sorry. No, I left Sri Lanka in 1982, came to Austin, Texas, UT Austin, to get my undergraduate and PhD there. And since then, I have been in the U.S. pharmaceutical industries. I have worked in 7 different companies. My last engagement was in India for about 3.5 years. That was actually a very educational experience for me. I mean, not simply was it an exciting job, but I was running a 200 scientist operation, serving nearly 25 clients in Europe, US, and Japan in drug discovery efforts. So they bring their projects to us, this outsourcing, what's called, I call it collaborative research. They bring their projects to us and we amplify it, we modify it and create drugs for them and hand it back to them. So it was a service job. And we were serving these 25 clients and I thought, this is a great way to help children because this technology exists. So our model is designed somewhat after that. It's a collaborative model. If you look at universities and institutes, this is where the genetics and the biology of diseases are being studied. Children's Boston, Children's Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Children's Cincinnati. These are cutting-edge institutes. But when they identify a potential therapeutic pathway for a disease, venture capital for a pediatric disease, let me correct, okay? Venture capital doesn't come flowing into that. Typical mm-hmm. biotech model is, say, for obesity or for cancer, adult cancer. I mean, they have found a pathway, venture capital come, they'll create a biotech, they'll elaborate the technology, have an exit pathway either to sell the company to a big pharma, or sell the technology to a big pharma. Everybody makes money, they go back and do the same thing over again. When it comes to pediatrics, these faculty members are doing cutting-edge research, but venture capital doesn't shine their light on it because it's not profitable, right? What we are going to do is go and talk to these people and say, let's collaborate. You are the specialist in biology. We are the specialist in drug design and drug discovery. And let's take together compounds into the clinic so that patients will get it. So it's a very collaborative, very interactive model. And it works, again, in a community setting because we are going to engage all these faculty members who are, some asked me, are you really going to collaborate with us? I said, yes. Mm-hmm. Our first project is going to come from NUMA Center for Childhood Cancer Research in Delaware. There are six faculty members there who are completely dedicated to pediatric cancer, and they're finding paths. Our first project will be in AML, acute myeloid leukemia for children. The prognosis today is 10% survival, and these faculty members have found an exquisite pathway that we can tackle with a small molecule drug, which will provide treatment. Mm. So
it's very exciting, isn't it?
Yes.
On your website, you state that MedChem scientists believe they can expedite the path to these breakthrough medicines.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the development cycle of traditional medicines and how much time they take from inception to being in the hands of the people that need it, and the development cycle of what you all would be able to do.
Yes, expedite is a critical word there because, you know, development cycles vary from types of diseases, the complexity of the biology, and things like that. So I cannot give you a number, say it's 3 years, right? It varies. And I have worked in 7 different companies. I have seen projects in ocular diseases to cancer to arthritis to immunology and various things like that. It all varies. But the thing is this, expedite in the sense that since the biology is already done at the universities, right? We already have a leg up. Right. We are not starting from zero. That zero work, the highest risk in the whole drug discovery process is biology and genetics. And that is publicly funded research in universities and institutes. Right? We tag along with them after they have finished their work. So think of drug discovery process as a 4x400-meter relay. Right? Every segment has to do its part to get the baton to the finish line. Right? This is exactly what drug discovery is. So the biology experts do the biology work. Drug design, drug discovery guys, us American MedChem and people like us in industry, do our part. And then we take it to the clinic, right? Clinic takes time because patients are now seeing the medicine. And if the drug is very, very efficacious, FDA gives what's an expedited review and process so that more patients can see it. In our cycle time, I would say, in the drug discovery segment in the middle part, I would say anywhere from 18 to 36 months is typical. Right? And the biology people have spent a lot of time doing the genetics because they ask questions, hypotheses, failures, start again. They keep doing that cycle, right? But when it comes to us, we already have an advantage to push it forward. So that's where that expedited term comes. It is not really, we don't have a technology to truncate the time. Nature drives this time, really, because the complexity of the molecule could be what takes extra time.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Celaya. He's the founder of American MedChem. And why Salt Lake?
Oh, why not? Right? I look at Salt Lake as, well, I came here to actually run a medicinal chemistry department for a small startup company called Prolexis. It doesn't exist anymore. But I love Salt Lake. It's beautiful. And also accessibility. I think being a collaborative organization, American MedChem would have to talk to both East and the West Coast. and this is a great place to be, you know.
Yeah.
We have access to the West Coast, fantastic research going on there in pediatrics, and we have access to the East Coast from here, nonstop flights to either coast. So it's convenient. It's beautiful. I think people like to come here and work. I think we'll be able to attract scientists to come here and work because we will have a group of scientists doing this work. And, you know, a lot of them who like the outdoors would come and mm-hmm. work here and enjoy. And I'm getting phone calls from people asking, you know, they love the cause.
Right.
Not the money. We don't have stock options and things like that. But they love the cause. So they want
so to more logistical and geographical than necessarily the collaborative efforts that you might have with the University of Utah, very strong biotech
right.
university and or primary children's hospital.
We are not limited.
Yeah.
I mean, we will be collaborating with the University of Utah, Huntsman Cancer Center and things like that. Mm-hmm. But we are not limited to, we will expand to working with both East and West Coast and embrace. Cincinnati is talking to me already. So.
Hmm.
Dr. Salaya, you look like a curious person.
Am I? I am a curious person. I think it's intriguing because, you know, life presents us with these opportunities to do good.
Yeah.
You know?
What one question would you like to see answered in the next 10 years?
Well, when there is a toolbox for pediatric physicians to comfortably say, here is a treatment I have for this child, that will be very gratifying, you know, because we don't have that now. I have sat across tables, you know, over dinner with pediatric oncologists, and some of them have shed tears because they go back to a child that is dying, and they know they don't have the tools. If we can make a change in that, give them the tools to treat these children. We won't be seeing patients, but these oncologists, they may not even know us, but if they have the medicine in their hand and say, here is the medicine that's going to make your child better, I think we would have accomplished a lot.
That's so nice. You gave me this nice little sticker that says breaking good.
Yes.
Instead of breaking bad. It says, not all chemists are bad. AmericanMedChem.org. It's meds for kids. And that's your Twitter handle.
Yes.
So Dr. Robert Salaya, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today. And best of luck
in
your
much.
Endeavor. Keep us informed on
yes.
how it goes forward.
Yeah, you've got to come back and see us.
Yes. We are, if I may, we are going about fundraising. We hope to start our labs Q3 sometime. So we will come back and tell you how we're doing. Thank
Excellent.
You, John. Thank you, Lynn.
How are you fundraising? Kickstarter?
No, really not. I mean, we can do Kickstarter when we are running projects because people associate projects and they can bring a crowd together. I'm actually reaching out to people who are wealthy who I actually call it an investment, but it's philanthropic investment. To
exactly.
come and be part of this and make a difference, all this vision can come true when people come together, right? So
nothing like an investment in our children.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the opportunity.
And we'll be right back.
Okay.
OP Rockwell is a proud supporter of KPCW, presenting Soul Review Big Band Solistics Saturday, March 7th. Lounge opens at 5 p.m. and the ticketed show begins at 8. OP Rockwell is located at 268 Main Street. More info at oprockwell.com.
Support for today's programming comes from Epic Promise, Park City Mountain and Canyon Resort's sustainability program, reminding listeners it's time to wake up and welcome in the 2014-15 season.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. Join me each week here on KPCW for the Splendid Table. We give you a fresh take on the subject of food with great attitude and originality. We look at the way food plays out in your life. It opens you up to the world around you and the Park City community. Each week you get tips, recipes, and everyday culinary know-how. The Splendid Table reminds us of the essential role breaking bread together holds in our world. That's The Splendid Table, Sunday mornings at 9, right here on 91.9 and 88.1 FM, KPCW.
Sponsored by River Horse on Main.
Want to thank our underwriters, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. You're listening to KPCW Park City.